Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 20th of March. Happy first day of spring. On Sunday of this week in Steubenville, Trent Mays and Malik Richmond were found delinquent of the rape of a 16-year-old girl. They will serve, respectively, a minimum of 2 years and 1 year each. But this story brings to mind a number of questions. Is there a connection between a jock culture, a sports culture, and sexual favors, and indeed even rape? Why is it that they thought they could get away with this, that their coach joked about what had happened? And why is it that so many people kind of stood there and didn't say anything? Is a grand jury investigation something that you welcome? And of course, the larger question is, how do we prevent rape in this country, which is a violent crime? All those questions came to our minds, and we thought that we would talk about it this hour of the program. We'll have two guests with us, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Sarah McMahon is one of our guests, assistant professor from the Center on Violence Against Women and Children at the Rutgers School of Social Work. Her work was quoted in a recent piece in some newspaper, and it quoted what she had done that was reported in the Boston Globe. She studies violence against women, and she looked at the sexual assault charges that had been levied against members of the Boston University hockey team, and looks at whether or not college athletes are more likely to commit sexual crimes than others. She is one of our guests this morning. Professor Sarah McMahon, thank you very much. That article actually was in The Nation, and the earlier article was in the Boston Globe. Sarah McMahon, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Jared Chin is also with us. Jared is Director for Training and Curriculum for Sport in Society at Northeastern University Center. Jared, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, great to be here.
Is there, let me start with you on this, Professor McMahon, have you found that there is some kind of link, and describe what that link may be, between a jock culture and a rape culture?
Well, I think that this has been a question that has been asked for a few decades, and I don't think that there's a conclusive answer that there's a clear link that athletes are necessarily more prone to committing sexual violence. There's been mixed research to try to answer that question, and some researchers have looked at athletes versus non-athletes to see, is there indeed an increased amount of sexual assault that occurs? And have found that no, there's not, that it's really just due to the fact that athletes are more well-publicized, and the media pays more attention when sexual assaults are committed by athletes. But other research has suggested that there are elements of the athletic culture which may make them more prone to acts of sexual violence and other forms of violence. Some of the research that I did tried to understand the athlete culture, and I wasn't trying to look to see if athletes were more violent, but instead was trying to understand what is it within this culture that may make them more prone to violence. In my opinion, I think there are many subcultures out there that can be prone to violence, and it's our task to try to understand what goes on within these various cultures. And so when looking at the athlete culture, there are certain elements that are there that could perhaps make them more prone to violence. One of them being, of course, the issue of entitlement. And for those of us who work in the field of sexual violence, we know that for an act of sexual violence to occur, there's a sense of entitlement that goes along with that. And when we look at how we value and treat athletes in our culture, down to the high school level, up to the college level and in professional sports, there's a sense of entitlement that often comes with that. And combined with other factors that may be at play, if it's a team that has norms that devalue women, if there aren't messages, clear messages coming from coaches or others that this kind of behavior is unacceptable, then it may be more ripe to commit acts of sexual violence.
Jared Chin, what did you find particularly troubling about this Steubenville rape trial?
I think there's Well, there's numerous things that are troubling, but for us, or for myself, I think the, and Sarah pointed this out, it's really a failure of the adults who are in this community, especially the coaching staff. You have people who really weren't condoning this, but were tacit in their approval of the behavior of these student athletes. And I think when we look at this, the text messages that were going back and forth between the players that the coach was going to take care of it and things like that indicate exactly what Sarah is talking about, that these athletes developed a sense of entitlement.
Mm-hmm.
And from that, they were able to then think themselves above the law. I also think kind of the disturbing piece, and it's something that we try to address in our program, MVP, which stands for Mentors in Violence Prevention, in our work with student athletes, is this idea of bystanders. And there was a lot of players probably on that team who knew what was happening, who didn't necessarily participate in the sexual assault and rape of this young woman, but didn't speak up and do anything about it. They probably knew that it was wrong. They didn't participate in it, but by them remaining silent, their silence allowed for, you know, tacit support of their behavior of their teammates.
That's a very troubling aspect of this, Sarah McMahon. In addition to the rape, the fact that people didn't say anything and they knew it was wrong. Why wouldn't somebody
Absolutely.
Say anything? Yeah.
Well, that's actually what we're researching right now at Rutgers, at our Center on Violence Against Women and Children. And we have a large grant to try to understand. We're looking on a college campus, but I think many of the themes resonate throughout. You know, why don't people step in? And this is something, the bystander effect is something that's been looked at for years in social psychology. And just more recently, we've been applying it to try to understand issues of sexual violence. And I think there are a number of reasons why. And when we look at adolescents in particular, we have to understand the role of social norms. And again, that pressure to fit in and not wanting to be the one to stand up and say something is wrong. When we've talked to students about why they don't step in, sometimes it's that they don't really identify the situation as a problem. So that's one area that we need a lot of work to help students understand what went on at the Steubenville case and other situations is problematic. And then to understand what options people have to step in, that sometimes it doesn't have to be about direct confrontation, but there are other ways that people can seek assistance. And so goals of bystander education programs, which are proliferating, are really to try to change the norms within student culture to say it is right to step in. And there were probably a number of those bystanders for the Steubenville case and other places where this has happened that did indeed think this was wrong and didn't agree with it, but didn't really know how to step in, didn't have the confidence to step in, felt the pressure of the norms, again, which is heightened for adolescents, as we know, to not be the one to step in.
Mm-hmm. For those, Jared Chin, whose moral compass was so off that they couldn't tell that something was wrong here, how can your moral compass be that off? What's missing?
I think it's a lack of empathy. You know, in the work that we do, you know, Sarah mentioned bystander programs that address sexual assault and domestic violence. Our program, MVP, was the first program in the country to use a bystander approach to deal with sexual assault and violence prevention. So when we deal with this issue, and the one thing that we do when we're working, and we work with really tough-to-reach populations, we work with athletes, and we work with the military, and that's the biggest thing, is this lack of empathy, that people don't see this. And what we try to get them to realize is that this issue just doesn't affect some other women, but it's the women that you know in your life, women that you care about. This could be an issue that affects your sister, your mother, your cousin, your niece. And when we frame it in that term, it really changes a lot of ways that people think, especially young men, about this issue. And we've been pretty successful at doing this. And it's that reason that, and the first thing we try to do is to have, we actually ask them, the first question that we ask them is, raise a hand if you have a woman in your life that you care about. And that from there, we're reframing this as their issue. Mm-hmm. And we want them to understand that this isn't just, you know, some some faceless woman that is subject to sexual assault or gender-based violence, but this is people that you care about on a daily basis that are facing this.
Professor McMahon, address further the moral compass going way off.
I think that the points that Jared makes about empathy are really important ones. And I unfortunately think that there are also still a number of myths that are present that are really based in sexism and the idea of sexual assault and who's raped and what girls' or women's behaviors mean. And so something like being dressed in a certain way or drinking alcohol or even starting to participate in some kind of intimate behavior, that means that she's asking for more. And, you know, when I teach about these issues, sometimes I think, are we still talking about, you know, these phrases like she asked for it? And I think we are. I think they've become much more subtle. So when I've talked to students about their beliefs, most of them at this point would say directly, it's not right to rape somebody, it's not right to force them, it's not right to give them alcohol. But then when you talk with them further, some students have identified these kind of gray areas, and they put clauses in, the but clause. You know, I think it's never the victim's fault, but you had to see the way that she was acting, and she seemed like she was really into it. And so I think all of those myths are still very present, and a big part of our education efforts need to be addressing and debunking those myths.
There has been a lot of criticism, Jared Shin, and I must say I was appalled by some of the coverage, the commentators on CNN particularly, who were talking about the destroyed careers of these athletes and, you know, these men who they seem to be portrayed almost in some ways as victims with very little attention until we came back from the break to the victim in this. Did you see a lot of that? Were you appalled by that?
Yeah, I found it really troubling about how people have been framing this issue, that these young men's lives are ruined and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And not, you know, and that again goes back to kind of this victim blaming culture that Sarah was talking about. Instead of focusing on this young woman, this girl who had been sexually assaulted, we focus on these two young men. And by doing that, what we're saying is we're minimizing that young woman's experience and the trauma that she's going through, and then saying that these young men who had control over their own actions, who decided to do this. And I think this is what our program really tries to focus on, is that this is not a woman's issue. This is a man's issue in a lot of ways. It's men that are perpetrating the majority of sexual assault and gender-based violence in our society. And if we don't, we use the term men's violence against women in our program because we want to be very clear about who's perpetrating this.
Mm-hmm.
And by not talking about these men and young men as perpetrators and kind of painting them as victims, we silence women who are survivors of this violence.
And media outlets certainly, Sarah, have a responsibility, perhaps, if not a respect, they don't take it as a responsibility. They certainly can help frame an issue and give us information on an issue that will help us move to a better place in this society. If you're framing this as these poor young lads whose careers are destroyed, what are we learning?
Absolutely. And, you know, to echo Jared's statements that if we don't call it what it is, it's shifting the responsibility to the victim. And we've seen that throughout history. Even the way that we passively talk about how many women were raped versus how many men have assaulted women. And in terms of the Steubenville case, kind of lamenting the young men's career possibilities and their good education and their good grades, and talking about how, you know, the sex offender registry that they're going to have to sign up as is going to really devastate their lives. To me, that was troubling because, yes, when you commit an act of sexual violence, such as sexual assault, then this is what we have in place as the repercussions. What I would say is that I think that we can use this as an opportunity to say that sexual violence and rape are community issues, and they do affect everyone, and they do affect the perpetrators. We need to not focus on the devastation given to the perpetrators, but in terms of prevention, we do need to think about how this affects so many different people. and how we really need to address this as something that everyone has a responsibility to take action on. So trying, again, to understand how bystanders react, how we're educating youth about these issues, how we're discussing it in the media, that everybody has a stake in trying to shift how we treat this issue.
I'm wondering if we can spend Jared Chin, and maybe this is unfair of me and people can take me on if that's the case, if we can spend a few minutes on football. It's my understanding that this area is a fairly poor area, and yet because of the success of the football team in Steubenville, they've been able to attract money for a good stadium. The town is really supportive of the football team. We all know what can happen when everybody loves football a great deal. We are reminiscing about Penn State, which wasn't that long ago, where there were horrific acts of sexual violence, and it was all pretty much covered up. We're looking at a sport that can be rather violent, and we're examining concussions and all of that. Is there something peculiar here about football, or am I on a reach?
I don't want to say you're on a reach, but I would disagree. I don't think there's anything particular about football. I think this is an issue for men to deal with. We know that men perpetrate 90% of all violent crime in the society, and that includes battery, sexual assault. But we also know that there's just a small percentage of men who are actually perpetrating that 90% of the violence. And so my question is, and I think this is what we need to ask about the Steubenville football team, is why did those majority of men who aren't, and boys, who aren't violent remain silent, right? And to me, that's the critical question here is I think it's easy just to say, oh, well, it's football, right? But we know that sexual assault happens in the military, right? There's
yes.
That invisible war, and we know how problematic that film that just came out, and we know how problematic sexual assault is in the military. We know that this happens in fraternities as well. And we know that it's happening on college campuses. We know that 1 in 4 women are going to be sexually assaulted by the time they're of age to graduate college. That's 25% of women that are going to be subjected to sexual violence. Yet, by just focusing on football or just focusing on the military or just focusing on fraternities, we're missing the larger picture that this is a gendered issue, that this is a problem men have. And if we want to address it, we need to have more men actively talking about this issue. We need good men, quote unquote, to be stepping up and saying that that behavior is wrong, it's unacceptable, and that we need to challenge our fellow men and boys about this and educate them about why this issue is so wrong.
Professor McMahon, do you agree?
I agree with Jared's statements in general, and I especially agree that we need to be focusing on looking at all the men who didn't participate in the assault and thought that it was wrong and try to better understand why they didn't speak up. To me, I do think that that's where our focus needs to be. That being said, I do think that sexual violence is largely a gender issue and one that we need to understand kind of masculinity and why this is a gendered issue. I do think that there are certain cultures or contexts where it may make it more likely for sexual assault to occur. And I think football is just one sport, but I do think it has some of the ingredients such as kind of an approval of violence. And again, I think even larger than that, though, is kind of where the community comes in and how we have glorified athletes and the sense of entitlement that goes along with it and the status that they achieve. And so I think if the norms in some of these smaller cultures, whether it's football, whether it's other sports, whether it's other all-male cultures like the military or fraternities, we need to understand what's going on that the norms there allow this violence to occur. And maybe it's is indeed Jared's point that we need to understand the norms as to why people aren't stepping in. Are issues like loyalty and athletics preventing people from being able to challenge their teammates or to be able to seek assistance from others when they think that something's going wrong?
We're going to take phone calls for both our guests, and we'll welcome them momentarily. Our guests this hour are Jared Chin, Director for Training and Curriculum at Sport in Society at Northeastern University Center, and Sarah McMahon, Assistant Professor from the Center on Violence Against Women and Children at Rutgers. University School of Social Work. Our phones are pretty busy right now, but they will be opening as we talk here. So if you want to join us, the number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls, and let's start with Dave in Cobb. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. I'm thinking about the victim more than any of the boys who did it, because the victim needs more help than the boys should have got at all. I think they should have got more of a sentence, you know, because that's a pretty serious crime. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Should they have had more of a sentence, Jared?
I think the hardest thing is we're dealing with 16 and 17-year-old boys who aren't fully cognitively developed. I'm always loath to say that they, you know, I didn't listen. I wasn't there for the whole trial. I didn't listen to all the facts. And I think, you know, I'm always loath, reluctant to question a judge's ruling about this. What I would say is that that I agree with the caller that he's talking about focusing on the victim, but I also think we need to figure out how we educate our young people about these issues. And Sarah said something interesting before we went to break about how do we get these messages out. And I think it really starts with educating coaches. Right? It can't just be about the X's and O's on the field. It has to be about what's happening in your locker room and how you create a culture that doesn't promote misogyny. And I think that's really, really important. And if those athletes had some education prior, maybe they don't make those decisions.
Here's an email that is relevant right now. Sarah McMahon, this goes to you from David in Lake Mills. I believe parents need to instill awareness and respect from the very beginning of a child's life that any violation of another person's body is a horrendous crime. I also believe the punishment needs to fit the crime. For a rapist to only receive 2 years of incarceration for such an act is so slight compared to what the victim has to carry with her throughout her life.
I think that his point is really well taken, and when we think about, you know, how do we prevent this from happening, that there's not a one quick fit solution. You know, doing an educational program for students is not going to fix this problem. It needs to come from all directions, and certainly parents and homes and the communities where students are growing up in, understanding how the environment influences individuals is really important. And when we talk about preventing sexual violence, we really, the opposite of that, right, is building respect for others. And so I agree that from a very early age, when we've talked about sexual violence prevention at our center, we've said we really need to be starting when they're in the womb and figuring out when they come out, how do we try to get people to respect one another based on their differences, understanding differences, and not feeling that it's okay to denigrate others. And that's why we need to look at some of these behaviors that might be considered less serious, like racist jokes, sexist jokes, some of the bullying that goes on, and understand how that starts to set a foundation very early on for saying that it's okay to denigrate others. And I believe that those kinds of behaviors are really linked to these acts of sexual violence, that there's a continuum of behaviors. And from the very beginning, we need to be addressing the entire continuum, not just saying that it's not right to sexually assault someone, but also to think about the language we use and how we talk about others, how we sexualize women and girls in the media. And those types of things all need to be addressed if we really want to try to prevent sexual
violence. Do we ever sexualize girls in the media? It's unbelievable, you know, and on the sidelines of football games and other sporting events to an incredible degree. Dave, thanks I'm sorry, Sarah?
No, I was just going to agree with that. I mean, just I have a young daughter, and just going and even looking at the clothes that are available in the stores. And so I think we send mixed messages to girls. On one hand, we're blaming them later when we say, oh, look how you dress,
right,
you went out to this party. But we're promoting them to sexualize themselves from a very early age.
Brad is next in Fountain. Hi, Brad.
Hi. Hey, I just had two thoughts, and my first one was in regards to this text message about that the coach is going to take care of it. I was curious if anybody knows if, you know, they were following up on that and possible charges or responsibility on the coach. And then my second point was, wouldn't the coaches, you know, obviously if they had texted about, you know, that he would take care of this for them, don't they have a definite responsibility to help shape and mold their the students or the players' moral ethics?
And some of them do. I'm sure some of them are great, and they can serve a valuable role doing just that, Jared, right?
Yeah, you see, there's fantastic coaches out there. If anybody's ever heard of Joe Ehrman, who's out in Maryland, I think it is, he talks about this all the time, that coaches really need to take on this responsibility around these issues. And I think that's, you know, that's where it really starts when you look at the culture of a sports team, is it starts with the coach and the coaches and how they promote their culture. If locker room talk around women and degrading women is acceptable, then how do you, and they're not challenging that, then how do you think that then maybe creeps off the field into players' behavior? It really takes coaches to being educated around these issues. And the fact is that they're not. You know, I teach a course here at Northeastern, a Title IX course, and what I'm hearing from my students, who are all professionals, who are all coaching at the master's program, is they don't have the skills to talk about these issues. When I sit down and I start talking with them about how sexual assault on campus is a Title IX issue, they didn't even know that it is, and they don't know how to have these conversations on both sides. They don't know how to talk with the female athletes, their women athletes, and they don't know how to talk with their male athletes about this issue. And if we're not able to have coaches who are fluent and able to talk about these issues, we're really doing these student athletes a disservice.
Well, what happens after an event like Steubenville? Does it get coaches and athletic departments and actually schools all over the country thinking we really need to teach sexual violence education?
Is that for me?
What, why don't you take that, and then, Sarah, yeah. I'd like for you to respond.
Yeah, I never know. I think some schools take a sigh of relief and say, geez, we dodged a bullet on that one. And some of them actually do some work around it. And some just bury their heads in the sand and just say, hey, it doesn't happen here. And then when something does happen, they're shocked. You know, it has to be something that people are talking about. And if they're not, then, you know, they're playing a game of roulette, and at some point in time, their number is gonna come to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just statistically, we know that.
Thanks, Brad, for the call, Sarah. This one goes to you. It's from Elena in Menominee. This is somebody who heard a couple pieces on NPR just this morning, the story of a woman in the military who was raped by multiple men in a variety of branches, and the story of two brothers who were raped by a priest when they were young. The men got $700,000. The woman in the military had her career ruined, and the rape victim in Steubenville managed to get a conviction and death threats. Could your guests address how our society responds differently to rape of men versus rape of women, and maybe say something about the sense of entitlement in the military? Is it similar to what happens in jock culture?
So there's some excellent points, and I think many points are embedded in that. And I do, again, think that there's been some research and suggestion, even theoretically, that there are specific contexts where sexual violence seems to be tolerated in a way differently than in other places. And one of those ingredients is kind of an all-male environment, and again, one where there's a lot of entitlement and possibly sanctioning of violence. And certainly we can understand that the military and that athletes and fraternities are those that have been more well-cited. So I do think that there are parallels. I know that the military is really taking a hard look at how violence is occurring within their different branches, and trying to understand, again, what are the norms there? And, excuse me, why are those men who do not agree with what's going on, why are they not speaking up, not making any change? What is this kind of bond or loyalty or fear? Some of the research that looked particularly at why all male cultures have this challenge is trying to understand, how do we teach boys and men about what it means to be masculine, and that one of the characteristics that is often kind of dominant in our society is that you have to be tough and you're loyal to others and you don't speak up, or else you're seen as either, you know, there's homophobic issues involved and afraid of being seen as weak or gay. And so all of those pieces, I think, you know, need to be addressed. And then the question about male sexual violence, I certainly think that that oftentimes is not given the attention that it needs. I think there are so many barriers for men to be able to come forward and to, first of all, acknowledge what may have happened to them and seek services and support from others who may not really understand their situation. And so when talking about violence, I think it's really important to understand that gender is often at the center of it. But even beyond that, I really think it's about power and power-based violence. And one way that's enacted is through gender-based violence, but there are other situations such as male-on-male abuse where it's really it's about power.
Right. Hugh in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I think just the other day, the Alabama State Legislature is exonerating 9 young men who were accused of rape some 81 years ago in the Scottsboro case, the famous Scottsboro case. They're finally being exonerated because of the lies of the women who accused them of rape, and they did it at many trials. They lied again and again and again. The lacrosse team at Duke, where a woman who is a murderess, it turns out, falsely accused them of rape, and the deans and the whole administration and the media immediately came down and said, they're guilty.
What about Steubenville, Hugh?
Women lie. Let me, you know, you all have got, you have rape shield laws that defend lying women. The justice system has been so distorted by the feminists,
I
just want to be really clear about this, right? And I think he brings up the point of false accusations.
Yes.
And if he's still on the line or if he's listening, I want him to know that only 3% of rape cases are actually false. All right? So this is, I think that's a huge issue. 3% of all rape cases are false accusations. That falls right in line with all other false accusations. He can look it up. The FBI has statistics on it. 3%, all right? So that means 97% of all actual rape cases are credible, right? And we also know that rape and sexual assault is one of the most underreported crimes, all right? So I always worry about when we say, "Oh, women just cry rape," because it's untrue. It's 3%, and it falls in line with all other false claims around crime.
Let's
just be clear about.
Does Hugh have a point that many young African American men, were charged with rape in the racist South many years ago?
He has a point on that, but as far as Duke and things like that, that was an all-white group. The whole lacrosse team. Yes, the Scottsboro Nine is a travesty of justice, and he has his facts wrong because one woman did actually recant before the trial. So I just want to be clear about this, right? And let's talk about modern times, right? Yes, race and racism is still a factor when we look at these issues. But I just want to, it's inextricable when we talk about different forms of oppression. But I just want to be clear that only 3% of rape cases are actually false claims.
Thank you. Thank you for making that clear.
That's really important.
Sarah McMahon, would you like to comment?
I have the same statistic in mind, so I'm very pleased to hear Jared bring that up. And I often get that kind of question. I think that the caller brought up issues probably that other people are thinking, so I'm glad we have the opportunity to address it. And I think being, you know, factual, again, about the idea of false reporting, I think we need to look, too, at why people believe that women you know, make this up. And I also think we need to understand sometimes how, why it's so difficult for women to come forward and why they also may decide not to move forward in pressing charges. And many times there's a lot of pressure on women not to move forward. And so for the victim in Steubenville, you know, I give her and her family a lot of credit for pushing forward with what I'm sure was very difficult for her to have to move forward in trying to understand how this this case, you know, moved forward and how it affected her and hearing the details, yet still pursuing
yes.
the case.
Yes. If anything, I have heard that this is something that may be vastly underreported. Do we know if that's true?
Yes, I know that the FBI has said at times that sexual assault is the most underreported crime. Jared, I'm not sure if you have current information on that.
I don't know statistically. I want to say that I think they say, I just don't feel comfortable. I know that you're right, that the FBI does call it. I just don't have the statistical number in my mind right now. But I know it's drastically underreported from what people think, especially when people think around false.
Here's a Facebook page that has come in. As the mother of college-age boys, the coaches very much do protect athletes. They see the promise of a young athlete and their future success. The kids learn from an early age they're above the law. A club or travel team athletes experience from a young age their parents are above the law, and they too are above the law. My kids saw parents drink heavily between and after games, driving then, doing things they normally wouldn't. I overheard moms in the presence of kids ask a young dad if he wanted sugar mamas. Sarah McMahon.
Well, I think that, you know, her observation is really keen. And again, it's about the culture and the community and how we're supporting the issue of sexual violence and allowing it to occur. And that we are building athletes and we are building this sense of entitlement from a very young age. And we really, I think, need to stop and take a look at that and try to understand why are we kind of obsessed in our society with this, with the idea of athletics. And while understanding and appreciating the wonderful aspects that athletics can provide, which I think there are many, why has it kind of taken on this role that's larger than life? Why are the salaries incredibly blown up? And why are we treating athletes in such a glorified manner? Again, building from such a young age and understanding the culture around that, and that it's not just on the athletes themselves. It's about us as a community and a society and how we're contributing to that.
Well, that's a very good question. Jared, how do you answer her why?
I'm sorry, my phone just cut out a little.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry you missed it. Essentially, why we're glorifying sports, why we have this whole culture around
yeah.
it. It's just, it's a very strange thing and so big in this society.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the issues that hasn't really been discussed here is the financial implications, right,
mm-hmm.
of why athletes are gain this sense of entitlement, especially young people, right? When we look at high school, we look at Steubenville, we understand that what, they have like a 16,000-seat stadium in this town of, I think, you know, is it,
yes.
they said it's 20,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's an economic engine, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if everybody's economic interests are tied to this football team because of, you know, we know it's in the Rust Belt, we know how bad the Rust Belt has suffered economically these past decades, we know that this is, and that this drives their economy, right? People show up, people spend money for these games, that there's an economic interest, right? I wonder how much they actually pay this coach, right? A salary. I bet you it's more than most teachers get at that school. And if that's the case, they have an interest of making sure that they keep players on the field regardless of their behavior, right? Because they need to win games to be able to stay employed. They need to keep people in the stands. They, you know, everything that goes along with this, right? So there's a complicitness here. It happens in college sports, right? We saw what happened with Penn State when economics took precedent over morality. And we need to figure out why that is. And I think Sarah's talking about why this happens in different cultures. I think it's really important. But to understand that if we're not talking about that, you know, this is, there's economic issues here, and that doesn't make it right. I'm not trying to justify it, mm-hmm. but I think people, when you're depending on 16 and 17 year olds for your economic future, that's problematic in a lot of ways.
We're going to welcome more phone calls in a moment. Jared Chin, one of our guests this hour, Director for Training and Curriculum at Sport and Society, Northeastern University. Sarah McMahon, Assistant Professor from the Center on Violence Against Women and Children at the Rutgers School of Social Work. We're talking about Steubenville, the rape case, and is there a bond between jock culture and rape culture, how the media talks about these kinds of issues, how our society raises young boys, and we have moved into a conversation of the economics of the sport culture as well. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, Before Greed, Americans didn't always yearn for riches. What happened? We'll talk about it, hour two of our program. Let's go back to phone calls. Jeff in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, this is a very interesting discussion this morning, and I agree with your guest that it must be seen first as really a gender issue, and that it's not uniquely football or military, but at the same time, I think we also have to think about what has gone on in the worlds of football and military that may be similar and may be worth considering. Your last email about people being above the law, I think we really have to consider it, and this is where this sense of entitlement and glorification has to be examined. And you know, I know this is going to sound like heresy to a lot of people, but after Vietnam, we shamefully castigated returning soldiers without discrimination, and now it seems we've swung to the other side. We glorify without discriminating. I mean, how many times on your show, on anyone on the radio, on Wisconsin Public Radio, have we heard in the past 10 years, as soon as someone mentions military, we say, thank you for your service, which is nice, but it's without knowing why the individual joined the military, whether it was to serve our country or was it to get some benefits. We don't know what he or she did, but we accept it now without discrimination. Your guest mentioned football budgets. Well, there's something similar. Consider defense budgets if we want to talk about entitlement. I just think we're a culture that has learned to so glorify violence in so many levels, and yes, beyond football and the military. But I really think those two stand out as examples of what we really need to look at if we're going to deal with these issues. And,
Thank you.
I'll listen.
Thanks, Jeff. Jared.
I think the caller brings up a really interesting point around, questioning, not questioning folks. It's an interesting point in the sense that, but I also want to be careful, right? Because it's really problematic if we think that all male soldiers do this, right? We know there's a professor up here in Boston, a man by the name of David Lisak, who's looked at people who perpetuate rape on college campuses, and he found that the majority of men actually don't perpetrate rape, but what happens is he calls them the undetected rapists, that most rape that's perpetrated on college campuses is perpetrated by serial rapists. That there's a small percentage of men on college campus who take advantage of rape culture and how a college campus is constructed around alcohol and drinking and hookup culture that take advantage of this. And I think that's, when we talk about this, I'm always reluctant to say, okay, well, all soldiers are doing this. We probably know, and I wouldn't be surprised if they did research, if they found out that things like what David Lisak is doing at UMass Boston around this issue is probably holds true in the military too. That there's a small group of soldiers who are perpetrating this. I wouldn't be surprised by that. Do I know for sure? No. And just one other thing, we asked beforehand about the statistic of how many rapes go unreported. The Department of Justice keeps track of this stat, and it's 54%. So I just want to make sure that I didn't leave that out there. That's 54% of rapes and sexual assaults in our society go unreported.
Mm, wow, that's a large number. Tina in Mindoro. Hi, Tina.
Hi. I've been both in the college situation and 20 years in the military and working in an emergency room. And alcohol is, I mean, that girl was very lucky she did not wake up dead from choking on her own vomit or tachycardic arrest from the amount of alcohol she poured down. And I've seen particularly the young men and women, they will wake up and have absolutely no idea who the person next to them is, how they got there, or what happened in the pursuing evening from hours earlier. And, I mean, there is the rape aspect that she was limp as a doll and the guys were up and moving. But there is the aspect of young people simply drinking themselves stupid. Every inhibition's gone. They don't know. If two people wake up and they both chug down a case, who raped who?
Professor McMahon.
I think that the caller brings up some really interesting points, and we haven't talked about alcohol yet
right.
today, and I think that it's a really important topic that we need to address. I think we need to be careful about how we address it. In terms of understanding, especially how it's prevalent within adolescent culture, and then trying to understand how it's intertwined with the issue of consent, which is very difficult and trying to understand. But we also need to know that having sex with somebody who is incapacitated or unable to give consent is considered sexual assault. And so when we do education at Rutgers and we talk about these issues, we say if somebody's been drinking, it's not a good idea to have sex with them. That they're, you know, the issue of consent, technically that person's not really able to give consent, and that's a really serious issue. The other piece we need to look at, again, is how a community or a group may facilitate a culture or a setting where sexual violence can occur. And a place that has a lot of alcohol, in particular, if it's a party situation and it may be boys or men or somebody feeding alcohol to another person, that should be considered an act of sexual violence. That giving someone alcohol is a type of drug-facilitated sexual assault. And so I think we need to have that discussion with youth about the risks involved with becoming incapacitated, but also understand the responsibility of making sure that people are able to give consent and understanding that if they can't, that can be considered sexual assault.
Thank you, Tina, for your call. Bob in Middleton, hi.
Yes, I am curious as to why so many, it's males who are serious about their sports who are involved in these things, and I wonder if they're not frequently using bodybuilding chemicals, drugs, as people like Lance Armstrong were using, and possibly Oscar Pretorius in South Africa, those drugs, as a side effect, increase libido tremendously.
Jared Chin.
I think when we talk about substances, whether it's performance enhancing drugs or like Sarah was talking about alcohol, it's an issue. But I don't want that to become an excuse, and I think that's really problematic, right? There's a lot of, you know, what we've seen in society is that there was a lot of people, and there still are a lot of people using performance enhancing drugs, and they're not out there committing sexual assault. Maybe there is, but it's a smaller percentage, right? So what we need to figure out then is it what Sarah is talking about, does it provide or does it facilitate sexual assault? And I think that's the main case, is that if we say, oh, well, it was alcohol or drugs that and that's the reason why they did that, we let men off the hook for their behavior, right? Because this is really, and I think Sarah hit it on, was really correct about this, this is an issue of power and control, and it's really about how we educate men, how we socialize young boys in our society. And if we tell them that, you know, boys don't cry, if we're telling them you can do, in a lot of cases, is to be a girl, right, mm-hmm. in our society, by the way we raise boys, right, it's the exact opposite is being a woman, right?
And on that note,
it's problematic.
We have to say goodbye. Well, thank you both so much. It was an important conversation, and thank you for all of your knowledge and care and concern. Thank you. Jared Shin, Director for Training and Curriculum, Sport and Society, Northeastern University. Sarah McMahon, Assistant Professor from the Center on Violence Against Women and Children at the Rutgers School of Social Work. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program. Thanks for all of your calls. We have another hour to go on greed. It's coming up.